worsening seemingly by the day. This past week is a preview of just how bad things can get. It's far past time to tackle this catastrophe with the focus and urgency it so clearly merits.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Israel has a history of either attempting to or conducting acts of terrorism in Iran, but more often than not, Tehran successfully discovers and prevents such attacks. On Saturday, Iran's intelligence ministry issued a statement saying that members of a terrorist group affiliated with Mossad were identified and arrested by Iranian security forces before they could take any action to carry out acts of sabotage. The ministry added that terrorists who were in contact with Mossad agents through one of the neighboring countries had sneaked into the country while carrying highly explosive bombs. Later, reports emerged that the espionage planned to blow up a sensitive facility in the central Iranian province of Isfahan. This, however, isn't the first time Israel had planned on carrying out acts of terrorism in the Islamic Republic of Iran. Iran's intelligence ministry forces had also captured individuals linked to Mossad in April. The spies were involved in disseminating classified information and documents. In July, Iran arrested another network of agents while they were carrying a large cache of weapons and ammunition with the intentions of provoking riots and terror inside the country.
Earlier in March, Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps foiled yet another Israeli act of terror. The Islamic Revolution Guard Corps said it stopped an imminent Israeli plot to sabotage the Fordow uranium enrichment plant.
Israel has, however, conducted a few terrorist acts against Iran over the past years, namely the murder of top Iranian scientists and army generals and acts of sabotage on nuclear sites. Yet, interestingly enough, the regime continues such atrocities without being held accountable by the international community, and more specifically the U.S., who has supported Israel through its veto power in the United Nations Security Council.
The impunity with which Israel carries out such attacks or in this case, makes such plans, is fully enabled by the United States of America, which at this point, I believe, should be deemed responsible for the crimes and the destabilization that the apartheid state of Israel engages in. The primary way that the United States enables the crimes and the destabilization of Zionism and the colonialist apartheid state of Israel is through its veto in the United Nations. Since 1972, the United States has vetoed 53 resolutions attempting to hold Israel to account by way of international law.
Israel has been involved in a string of sabotage attacks on Iran's nuclear facilities in recent years and has killed many top nuclear scientists and military officials in cowardly strikes. More recently, on May 22nd, Colonel Hassan Sayyad Khodai was assassinated by two motorcyclists who shot him 5 times before fleeing the scene. He was dismounting his car to enter his home in an eastern neighborhood of the Iranian capital when 3 bullets hit him in the head and 2 bullets in the hand. While Israel has yet to officially comment on the incident or take blame, all reports and facts indicated that it has so far been behind the terrorist activities in Iran. Regarding the Khodai case, American outlet The New York Times cited an intelligence official as saying that Israel has informed American officials that it was behind the assassination. Despite all this, the regime continues its petty attempts of trying to accuse Iran of destabilizing the region.
Israel attacks its neighbors on almost a daily basis, for example, bombing Syria, whereas Iran has not attacked a neighboring country in over 300 years, or almost 300 years. Furthermore, the very well-known international human rights organizations, Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, as well as B'Tselem, the Israeli human rights organization, have deemed Israel to be an apartheid state, which inherently, as such, destabilizes the region. So there's nothing new here in terms of the Israeli and American narrative, their propaganda regarding Iran. What I do see as new and heartening is the fact that the effectiveness of this narrative is weakening very rapidly.
Israeli atrocities have also garnered fierce response from Iranian officials. The chief commander of the Islamic Revolution Guard Corps has warned that Iran will take a harsh revenge on those who assassinated a member of the force in Tehran.
The commander of the Iranian Army's ground force has warned that Tehran will raise Tel Aviv and Haifa if Israel makes any attempts against Tehran. Brigadier General Qumars Haydari also stated that Israeli occupied territories will be liberated in less than 25 years. Russia says it might go beyond Donbas, where it once laid the lines of the conflict in Ukraine. The shift was articulated by Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, who said one reason Russia might expand its operation are the longer-range rockets and artillery the US and NATO allies have been funneling to Ukraine.
The geography is different now. It is not only about the DNR and the LNR, but also about the Kherson region, the Zaporizhia region, and a number of other territories. And this process is continuing consistently and persistently.
Lavrov's remarks are the clearest comments that Russia's objectives have expanded over the 5 months of war. Earlier, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said Lavrov's statement confirmed what Washington and its allies had suspected were Russian President Vladimir Putin's objectives all along.
He has stated a number of times that, you know, this is a limited operation focused on the Donbas. His actions have proven otherwise.
The U.S., despite claiming that it knew about Russia's intentions, only seems to be further fueling the war through its support for Kiev. The U.S.'s military assistance has topped $8 billion U.S. dollars, part of a $40 billion aid package. And all this while analysts view diplomacy as the only tangible solution to the ongoing conflict.
The U.S. empire's strategic aim is to expand NATO eastwards, right up to the borders of the Russian Federation, stage coups where necessary, as in Ukraine in 2014. And in the words of Canada's Deputy Prime Minister, Chrystia Freeland, to vanquish Russia, divide it up and gobble up its component parts, the better to march on to China. It's a hegemonic agenda, and there is no way that the U.S. will tolerate the Ukrainian government having a negotiated peace with Russia. Rather, the plan is that to drag the Russian Federation into a long war.
Washington claims to be supporting Ukraine to defend itself. Officials in Kiev have, however, suggested that Crimea, which the West still recognizes as part of Ukraine, could be a target for U.S.-made missiles recently deployed by Kiev. The remark, however, prompted a fierce response from the former Russian president, warning that an attack on Crimea will ignite a Judgment Day response. The West, led by the U.S., apart from supplying financial aid, has also imposed a wide range of unprecedented sanctions against Moscow in support for Kiev. The bans have targeted individuals, banks, businesses, and state-owned enterprises, including the oil and gas sector.
The U.S. also planned an economic war on Russia by leveling economic sanctions which are unilateral and illegal, by excluding Russia from the SWIFT transfer system, by stealing its monetary resources stored in Western banks, and by cutting it off from its natural trading partners in Europe.
The economic impact of the war and the sanctions on Russia is showing across the world. Inflation is up in many countries, global supply chains have been disrupted, and there are fears of food shortages. But now, experts fear the situation, especially in Europe, could further deteriorate as the continent struggles to find middle grounds on solutions to the current uncertainties.
But the U.S. sanctions backfired on the West, especially on Europe, where Europe took the brunt of the energy cutbacks. And it caused the U.S. war caused an inflationary crisis for the entire world.
All this has also led to indications of fatigue settling in the EU. The Hungarian Prime Minister has so far been the most vocal about his concerns regarding the bloc's strategies on Ukraine.
West's strategy on Ukraine has failed as governments in Europe are collapsing like dominoes. Energy prices have surged. A new strategy is needed, which should focus on peace talks and drafting a good peace proposal instead of winning the war.
But despite the heavy costs incurred by Europeans, the bloc's leaders seem to have set their eyes on continuing their way. While standards of living in many countries have already deteriorated drastically in light of decisions made by policymakers, problems may further worsen in the future. The International Energy Agency has even warned that a potentially disastrous natural gas supply crunch this winter awaits Europe, mainly due to the possibility of Russia cutting off gas supplies completely.
U.S. President Joe Biden just visited the West Asia to promote Washington's agenda in that region. Apart from encouraging Washington's Arab allies to pump more oil into the market to bring down rising energy prices, Biden, on behalf of the Israeli regime, was trying to form a coalition against Iran. But the much-publicized event failed to garner support from the United States' Arab allies. Now, Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani says the latest plot in the West Asia region failed because the regional countries do not trust Washington. Kanani also said Iran considers the security of its neighbors as its own security.
The Saudis are recognizing the U.S. is in decline, and Joe Biden is the symbol of America's decline, mentally, politically, socially, religiously. And they have embarked on a different geopolitical, economic, military agenda, and that is to unite with the BRICS nations and seek their political destiny elsewhere than within the United States. So I think Joe Biden's trip was an absolute failure. It didn't accomplish anything, and we knew it wouldn't accomplish anything.
Just the day before the summit between Biden and the Persian Gulf Cooperation Council countries, plus Egypt, Jordan, and Iraq, Mustafa al-Kadhimi, the Prime Minister of Iraq, said Baghdad will not be part of any camp or military alliance. He also said, quote, Iraq will not be a base for threatening any neighboring countries. The UAE, which is a close ally of both Saudi Arabia and the US, also dismissed the idea of forming an anti-Iran NATO-like military alliance. We are open to cooperation, but not cooperation targeting any other country in the region, and I specifically mention Iran. Such comments show that Biden, who has practically followed the anti-Iran policies of his predecessor Donald Trump, failed to achieve his stated objective of forming a military alliance against Tehran.
So this entire trip of Joe Biden's was a futile effort, wasted effort, and I think it only depreciated America in the eyes of other nations. And for that reason, other nations are seeking political alliances elsewhere, in other global institutions, such as the BRICS nations, and the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative and other things.
Iran's foreign ministry spokesman also dismissed the recent Israeli threats against the Islamic Republic as psychological warfare. Nasser Kanani says the Tel Aviv regime has neither the courage nor the capability to confront Iran militarily. He also vowed that Tehran would give a decisive and destructive response to any Israeli aggression. Iran's response to any idiocy committed by the Zionist regime would be destructive.
Not only is the United States incapable of any military conflict, but Israel is also incapable of any military conflict. And Israel is incapacitated, yet they are putting on an aura of functionality, an aura of threats. But at the heart, Israel has no capacity to wage a conflict against Iran. This is all bluff, and this trip confirms it.
Kanani's comments come in response to threats made by Israeli Army Chief Aviv Kohavi. The Israeli general has said, quote, it's Israel's moral obligation to prepare a military response against Iran's nuclear program. He also added that such preparations for such a strike are at the center of the military's program. Kohavi's warmongering rhetoric against the Islamic Republic comes despite Iran's insistence that it's not seeking to develop nuclear weapons. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei, has issued a religious decree against weapons of mass destruction. And just recently, Kamal Kharazi, the head of Iran's Strategic Council on Foreign Relations, rejected allegations that Iran seeks nuclear weapons. He said Iran has the technical capability to go beyond the current 60% uranium enrichment level, but it will not go that path. It's an open secret that Israel is the sole possessor of nuclear weapons in the region and has hundreds of warheads. The regime's officials have constantly threatened Iran with strikes on its nuclear facilities. The regime is responsible for the murder of a number of Iran's nuclear scientists. It has also carried out sabotage attacks against Iran's nuclear facilities. And its latest threats against Iran are just meant to shore up its crumbling hegemonic position.
As the crisis in Ukraine lingers on, the United States and its allies appear to run out of measures to halt Russia. They have imposed various sanctions on Moscow. Russia's energy, banking, and financial sectors have been targeted by the West. But the punitive measures do not appear to have the intended results. Now, the United States is proposing the idea of putting a price cap on Russia's oil.
Yeah, this is more suicidal stuff from the West. Which this Western-centric, this US-centric, European-centric view of themselves as being indispensable parts of the world, I think is the main problem here, because they view themselves as the center of the universe, so to speak, in everything, in politics, economics, etc. However, they fail to understand that the world is rapidly changing.
The West is trying to limit the price of Russia's oil in order to deprive the country from the money it needs to run the war. The goal is said to be to set the price at a level that covers the marginal cost of production so that Russia would be encouraged to keep producing oil. The idea, which was first proposed by Washington, was agreed upon at the G7 summit back in June. Western countries plan to allow only those raw material and oil products whose value does not exceed the price cap. In reaction to the proposed idea, Russia has threatened that it would not export oil to the world market if a price cap is imposed. If these prices, which they are talking about, are lower than the costs for oil production, naturally, Russia will not ensure the supply of this oil to the world market, which means that we simply will not work at a negative profit. It's not yet clear whether Western nations have the capability to implement such a plan, but there are already warnings that this scheme may actually backfire. Russia's president says the price cap would further propel global oil prices, and Security Council Deputy Chairman Dmitry Medvedev has warned that oil would be traded between $300 to $400 per barrel if the West goes through with the plan.
The European markets and the US markets are not the prime markets for Russian energy supplies. The prime markets are now Asia. And so they are out of step with what is happening in the world. And what this will do will exacerbate, as you noted, an already rather tenuous energy crisis, which is caused by, on the one hand, shortages of energy supplies, and on the other hand, costs of energy supplies. Because to cap it, who's going to sell it to the West under the production cost? No one, especially when the West treats them the way that they are treating them. So, I mean, it's going to be another shot in the foot for the US and its vassal and client states.
Some analysts are predicting that the scenario would be catastrophic for the US and the other group of seven countries. Market watchers have predicted that China and India, two key players in the Asia region, may not cooperate with the price cap. Western sanctions on Russia have already failed to deprive the country from its revenues. They have actually increased the money Moscow makes from its energy exports. Oil prices climbed to 14-year highs shortly after the war began on February 24. They remain above $100 per barrel. According to other analysts, history shows that such attempts end in failure. The US tried to fix prices for oil in the 1970s, and the UK tried to set the forex prices in the 80s. All those attempts failed, and the prices boomed after those debacles.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The failure by global policymakers to act decisively to address the climate emergency threatens to erase decades of progress in the fight against childhood malnutrition in the global south, according to a new study by researchers at Cornell University. Please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Julia Conley, journalist. This article is published under the heading Extreme Heat Could Wipe Out Decades of Gain in Fight Against Child Malnutrition, a study shows. Here's more. The failure by global policymakers to act decisively to address the climate emergency threatens to erase decades of progress in the fight against childhood malnutrition in the global south, according to a new study by researchers at Cornell University. The study shows that children in low-income countries are increasingly suffering from both acute and chronic malnutrition as their communities experience the effects of extreme heat, which is becoming more prevalent and severe around the world as fossil fuel extraction persists and carbon emissions rise. Sylvia Blum, who earned a PhD from Cornell University in 2021 and led the study published earlier this month in the Journal of Environmental Economics and Management, said in a statement last week that as the number of hot days increases, we find that the prevalence of child malnutrition increases to a pretty high degree. Blum and her co-authors compared household survey data from 1993 to 2014 in five West African countries, including Benin, Togo, Ghana, Burkina Faso, and Côte d'Ivoire, with geocoded weather data collected by Princeton University, tracking the hours of exposure to extreme heat over children's lifetimes and during heat shocks. The study examined the effects of extreme heat on more than 32,000 children aged 3 months to 3 years old, finding that the average level of extreme heat exposure increased the prevalence of a stunted growth from chronic malnutrition by 12%. The prevalence of low weight from acute malnutrition increased by 29%. The research comes as climate experts are warning that global policymakers are not doing enough to limit planetary heating to 1.5 degrees Celsius. If the global temperature rise reaches 2 degrees Celsius, as scientists warn, it is likely to, without major reductions in emissions, the average effect of heat exposure on stunting would nearly double, said the researchers. That means the level of child malnutrition in the global south would wipe out gains made by anti-poverty initiatives over the study period. We're talking about children at a very young age that will have changes for the rest of their lives, so this is permanently scarring their potential, said Ariel Ortiz-Boca, an associate professor and applied economist at Cornell, adding, "We are doing to reduce global poverty, and it is being eroded by our lack of action on climate." Programs that resulted in improved incomes, infrastructure, and child care practices during the study period help reduce stunted growth by 5.8% on average. While this progress has been welcomed in West Asia and in other low- and middle-income countries, it's occurring against the backdrop of rising temperatures and an increased likelihood of extreme weather events, said John Hodinot, a professor of food and nutrition economics and policy at Cornell, adding, "Our work suggests these rising temperatures risk wiping out that progress." The researchers said they believe the casual effects of extreme heat on malnutrition are not psychological and physiological responses to direct heat, but are rather related to factors including higher risk that children will be exposed to pathogens from food and water that's been exposed to heat, lower consumption of protein from animal sources due to reduced agricultural productivity could also be behind the spikes in malnutrition. The study was revealed that as extreme heat killed more than 1,000 people in Europe, broke a 40-year record in Tunisia's capital city as temperatures reached 118 degrees Fahrenheit and melted tar and buckled roads in China. Stephen Pawson of NASA Goddard Space Flight Center said, "Such extreme heat has direct impacts on human health."
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
all of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel. Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The following is the text of the speech delivered on June the 28th, 2022, by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the head of the judiciary branch and a number of the top officials and employees of the judiciary. The Battle of Uhud had finished. Someone like Hamza, Sayyid al-Shuhada, had been martyred in this battle. The Quraysh, their agents, went into Medina and started frightening people. They came and asked the people, "Do you know what's happening? Have you heard? The enemy has gathered and has prepared an army. They want to put an end to you. They will attack tonight, and they will do this and do that." They, the enemy, was intimidating the people. Those who were the target of this intimidation said, "Allah is sufficient for us, and He is an excellent trustee." The Muslims went, defeated them, and returned. So they returned with favour from Allah. They obtained a large amount of spoils from the battle, and no problem arose for them. They defeated the enemy and returned. This is divine tradition. So, if in the face of the enemy's intimidation, you truly have faith that Allah is sufficient for us, and He is an excellent trustee, and if you do your duty, this will be the outcome, the victory. This part of chapter Ali Imran tells us this tradition. This is what happened after the Battle of Uhud. Perhaps this was about a few hours after the end of the Battle of Uhud.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
That other case was related to the Battle of Uhud itself. In the Battle of Uhud, the Muslims were victorious in the beginning of the battle. First, they attacked and crushed the enemy. But when they neglected the strait because of worldliness, the situation became reversed. Again, in chapter Al-Imran, the Qur'an states that, "And certainly Allah made good to you His promise." The Holy Qur'an, Surah 3, 152. God fulfilled His promise to you. He had said, "We promised that we will make you victorious if you struggle on the path of God." He carried out His promise. "When you slew them by His permission." The Holy Quran, Surah 3, verse 152. "You were able to put pressure on them, the enemy, and to defeat them due to God's grace. You succeeded in the beginning of the battle." So God did what He had promised in this part.
You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio, with you every single moment.
In the Limelight.
Around half of U.S. seniors living alone can't afford their basic necessities, statistics published recently revealed, underscoring calls for legislation to expand Social Security and lower prescription drug prices. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Brett Wilkins, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Around Half of U.S. Seniors Living Alone Can't Afford Basic Expenses, a study shows. Here's the story. Around half of U.S. seniors living alone can't afford their basic necessities, statistics published recently revealed, underscoring calls for legislation to expand Social Security and lower prescription drug prices. 54% of older U.S. women who live on their own and 45% of older men in the same situation are either impoverished by federal standards or cannot cover their necessary expenses, according to the Elder Index, a project of Gerontology Institute at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. For older couples, the figure is 24%. The Elder Index confirms that we already knew the cost of living is just too high for older Americans, and their earned benefits aren't keeping pace with these costs, the Alliance for Retired Americans tweeted in response to the report. Ramsey Alwin, president and chief executive of the National Council on Aging, told Kaiser Health News, KHN, that the group hopes to promote a robust dialogue about the true cost of aging in America. There is a myth that Social Security and Medicare miraculously take care of all of people's needs in older age, said Alwin, adding, the reality is they don't, and far too many people are one crisis away from economic insecurity. William Arnone, CEO of the National Academy of Social Insurance, told KHN that the poverty rate just doesn't cut it as a realistic look at the struggles older adults are having. The Elder Index is a reality check. KHN interviewed Fran Seeley, an 81-year-old retired school teacher in Portland, Maine, whose monthly income consists of $925 in Social Security payments, $287 from an individual retirement account, and $400 from a reverse mortgage. Seeley's annual income of $19,300 falls well below the $22,560 the index deems necessary for an older adult in excellent health living in a home they own with no mortgage payments. With high inflation straining her budget even further, Seeley said that, I have to cut back in any way I can. The biggest worry I have is not being able to afford living in my home or becoming ill, she told KHN. I know that medical expenses could wipe me out in no time financially. Mm-hmm. The Equity in Aging Collaborative, a new initiative by 25 advocacy groups seeking to address issues of poverty among older adults who have and continue to face inequities across their lifetimes, is planning to use the index to influence lawmakers to enact laws and policies that ease the financial burden of aging. Introduced last October by Representative John B. Larson, the Social Security 2000 A sacred trust would, if passed as written, increase program benefits, protect against inflation, end the 5-month waiting period for disability benefits, strengthen the Social Security trust funds, and implement other measures. Meanwhile, the pharmaceutical industry is fighting to torpedo Senate Democrats' modest proposal to reduce prescription drug prices by requiring Medicare to directly negotiate the prices of a limited number of medications. Surveys have shown that expanding Social Security and allowing Medicare to negotiate drug prices are overwhelmingly popular with voters. According to recent data for Progress Polling, 76% of all likely U.S. voters support the former policy, while 83% back the latter.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
You dismissed us and it has cost taxpayers 70.
After the warm-up bouts of debates featuring multiple leadership candidates, it was time for the final two to square off in a live televised debate. The head-to-head was the first opportunity viewers, including the estimated 170,000 members of the Conservative Party eligible to vote in the leadership race, could see Liz Truss, Foreign Secretary, face off against former Chancellor Rishi Sunak. Each wasted little time attacking each other's records and credentials and clashed heavily on their individual taxation plans to bring the country out of its worst cost of living crisis in generations.
We are an outlier. Everybody understands that COVID is a 1-in-100-year event, and trying to pay it back straight away so quickly that we actually damage our economy, that we end up causing a recession, that we end up in people being out of work, and that hard-working taxpayers who do the right thing have seen their taxes rise, despite the fact that we promised in our manifesto
Hang on, Faisal. You just mentioned three countries. Do you know what mortgage rates are in the US at the moment? Do you want to use them as an example? Their mortgage rates are almost 50% higher than mortgage rates in this country because they're borrowing so much.
Canada actually has project fear.
The candidates vying for the country's top job have not shied away from going after each other's political juggler. Some of the exchanges have been brutal, with the former chancellor accused of talking down to his political rival, while Liz Truss has honed in on Rishi Sunak's immense wealth. Now, Tory grandees are fearful that whoever wins this vote, it's actually the Tory party with all of this mudslinging that will be the eventual loser. Former Mayor of London Ken Livingstone has been keenly observing the leadership race. Polls have Rishi Sunak trailing Liz Truss amongst rank-and-file Tory members, and with ballot papers being sent out in early August, both candidates want to build momentum. The results of the leadership ballot will be revealed on September the 5th, still years ahead of a general election that will see the nation have the final say. Amina Taylor, London.
A UK-based Israeli arms manufacturer has been raided once again by Palestine supporters, who claim to have inflicted significant damage on the property. The building belonging to UAV Engines was hit last Sunday as part of a wider campaign by Palestine Action activists to harass and hamper the activities of the international arms firm Elbit Systems.
Palestine Action claim that their latest direct action was in retaliation to Israeli regime attacks on the Palestinian city of Nablus in the West Bank on Sunday morning, killing at least two Palestinians and injuring many more. The group also vows that as long as Israeli aggression against Palestine continues, so will their campaign, targeting not just Israeli arms manufacturers in the UK, but also their partners as well.
Following Sunday's action, supporters gathered to protest outside UAV's gates in solidarity with the activists who were detained following the direct action.
The drone parts that are made here are used, are tested on the captive population of Gaza. We know that these drones have killed people, and we're here today to stop the arms trade overall, but specifically against Elbit.
Palestine Action have always said, if you continue with this violence against the Palestinian people, then we will retaliate, we will resist, we will come back, we will shut down your factories.
The attack by Israel on Nablus is a common occurrence across occupied Palestine. The lack of action by Western powers to rein in Israeli aggression has inspired more aggressive activism. Palestine Action say their relentless raids have successfully forced the closure of two Elbit sites in London and Oldham. A spokesperson for Elbit acknowledged the incident, claiming it was an attack by a violent group. Although no one was harmed during the raid, Palestine Action's sites remain squarely fixed on UAV engines, so locals can expect more of the same scenes going forward. Robert Carter, Shenstone.
Several days ahead of the lunar month of Muharram, people in Afghanistan are preparing to mark the martyrdom anniversary of the third Shia Imam and grandson of the Prophet Muhammad, Imam Hussein. On Kabul streets, people have held Muharram exhibitions, where they provide necessities for mourning rituals.
We have been holding such Muharram affairs for more than 20 years. We deploy necessities for mourning ceremonies across Afghanistan. However, Muharram always has its own prosperity, but this year it is very different for our people. As we see, people are set to mark a widespread and more passionate Muharram.
Afghans also turn the mosques and public religious places black to express the emotion of grief on the martyrdom anniversary of their third Imam.
We are preparing to hold Muharram mourning ceremonies in Abul Fazl Shrine. The servants and lovers of Imam Hussein are decorating here with black as an old Afghan religious culture. God willing, we will host a sizable population of mourners during Muharram days, especially in Ashura.
With the Taliban responsible for ensuring security, Afghan Muslims, especially Shias, hope that they can hold their festivities in a peaceful space.
As you know, in the past years, there were security threats, especially by the Daesh terrorist group. Now that the invasion has ended and the Taliban are in power, I hope they tighten the security in advance and provide a safe ground for Muharram mourners across the country. They should cooperate and engage with the people and mourners to foil evil schemes.
Muslims around the globe largely commemorate the Battle of Karbala to keep the spirit of resistance and fight against arrogance alive. They also honor Imam Hussein's sacrifices, renewing allegiance with his ideals. Every year, millions of people in Afghanistan passionately mourn the martyrdom of Imam Hussein during the month of Muharram. Now here in the capital city of Kabul, preparations are underway for large processions. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The global stage for talents. The 5th International Stage Stars Festival wrapped up with the announcement of winners, who have been competing in four categories of singing, voice acting, show hosting, and sound impression. The top performances from each category won the Golden Mic and a cash prize.
The festival was a place for more serious competition between those who have a say in a stage performance. I'm so happy to be chosen by the jury as the best show host of the contest.
It was an amazing event for talents. I'm so glad to be part of this. Talents from all across Iran and many parts of the world competed in the festival, so winners should be proud of themselves.
Held in Iran's city of Rafsanjan, the two-day event brought together participants from 14 countries, including Iran, Afghanistan, Kyrgyzstan, Nigeria, and Turkey, to flaunt their neck for stage performance.
The scale of this contest is global. Many of us participants did not have any idea we could be stand-up comedians or show hosts. But when we got on stage here, we ourselves discovered our own talents.
I really love that, seeing that all people around the world are coming here and presenting themselves. It's a very great feeling. Of course, they will be progressed and they will develop yourself when they will get the result.
The jury is comprised of top Iranian actors, TV presenters, and voice artists. They say the competition has been tough, and those who stood out are real stage stars.
We tried our best to pick talents who really acted like professionals on stage. Not only should they care about the standards and principles of a stage performance, but they must innovate, improvise, and stand out.
This festival acted like a university for stage talents. It taught a lot of lessons about the stage to participants, especially for those who failed to win the contest.
Organizers say this contest is not just about scouting for stage talents. They say the event helps shine a spotlight on talents and lead them to their community.
The fifth Stage Stars Festival is aimed at bringing stage talents to light. Many of the participants already have a few years of experience, so this stage is not supposed to discover them, but to springboard them to a higher level in their careers.
All of the contestants, even those who come from foreign countries, must perform in Persian. However, organizers plan to include other languages in the upcoming editions of the festival.
To those who won the Golden Mic here, this is a dream come true. But they say, aside from the prize, Stage Stars has marked a milestone in their pursuit of success, since they have now come under the spotlight. Yusuf Jalali from the city of Rafsanjan.
A big sit-in was held inside the Red Cross office in the blockaded Gaza Strip on Monday in solidarity with Palestinian prisoners on hunger strike. On Sunday, scores of Palestinian prisoners started a mass hunger strike to support two of their fellow prisoners who have been on hunger strike for several months to protest their administrative detention. Around 500 Palestinian prisoners are being held without charge or trial under the so-called administrative detention, while their incarceration periods can be renewed indefinitely. Some prisoners have been held in administrative detention for more than 10 years. Their only recourse to draw attention to their plight has been hunger strikes. Among them, Khalil Awaude has been refusing food since March, and Raed Rayan has adopted the same passive resistance approach since April.
Yesterday, dozens of Palestinian detainees from different factions entered an open-ended hunger strike in solidarity with two Palestinian detainees who are going on their long hunger strike protesting the administrative detention, Khalil Awaude and Raed Rayan.
Currently, some 5,000 Palestinian prisoners are held in 24 Israeli prisons and detention centers. Families of Palestinian prisoners have slammed the silence of the international community over the plight of their loved ones.
I want to talk about the silence of the international community and the United Nations. I sent many letters about my son's case to all of them to intervene with the Israeli government to talk with them about my son's case, but unfortunately no response from all of them.
Prisoners' advocacy groups also condemned Israel's treatment of the Palestinian prisoners who are subjected to inhumane and degrading conditions, including solitary confinement and bans on family visits.
Palestinian detainees nowadays are subjected to inhumane practices by Israeli prison services. Therefore, we are here today to convey a message to the international community, especially to the ICRC, to put pressure on the Israeli government to stop such policies and to end the Palestinian suffering, Palestinian detainees' suffering.
Many here believe that the support Israel enjoys from some countries like the United States gives it the green light to act in contradiction with international law regarding the treatment of prisoners.
Statistics show that the Israeli regime has arrested around 1 million Palestinians since 1967, including women and minors. Among them, some 50,000 administrative detainees. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Algerian Foreign Minister Ramtane Al-Amamra has met Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in Damascus and handed him a letter from Algerian President on bilateral relations and preparations made for the upcoming Arab League summit in Algeria. Assad said the Arab League is the mirror that reflects Arabs' status quo, asserting what matters to Syria is the content and result of joint Arab action rather than the form. Amamra said Syria is a basic element on the Arab arena and that the Arab world needs Syria, not vice versa. He stressed that Algeria will remain standing beside and coordinating with Syria regarding Arab and international developments during its presidency of the Arab League summit. The top Algerian official also held a separate meeting with his Syrian counterpart. The two sides agreed to boost economic cooperation and establish a joint higher committee for this purpose. However, the main topic was how to bridge gaps in the relations between Syria and some Arab countries, as Algeria is exerting efforts to bring back Syria to the Arab League.
If you ask Arabs, does Syria have a legitimate seat in the Arab League? The answer would be yes. Is Syria's absence from the Arab League in the benefit of any side? The answer is no. Syria's absence harms joint Arab action. Are there means to solve this situation? This is the core of my consultations with Arab brothers. We are optimistic.
Muqdad asserted that the issue is beyond just attending or not attending the Arab League summit.
We coordinate with Algeria and some Arab countries, regardless of Syria's membership in the Arab League. What is important now is to coordinate policies and come out with conclusions that serve Arab goals. Syria supports all measures that renew Arab stances, solidarity, and an Arab understanding of importance of joint coordination between all of us to face mutual challenges.
Algeria is one of the few Arab countries that remained supportive to Syria during its crisis, as it condemned terror and rejected economic sanctions on Syria.
This is the first official visit of an Algerian foreign minister to Syria in years. It comes as Algeria strives to unite Arab states and enhance Arab-Arab relations ahead of hosting the upcoming Arab League summit in November. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Evidence continues to mount that Europe's sanctions campaign against Russia is exacerbating the euro currency's persistent and perhaps structural economic troubles. France's finance minister just released a depressing outlook. This year's economic growth will be cut almost in half and remain between just 1.4 and 1.8% until at least 2028. The Eurozone's second largest economy now looks too weak to drive what many have long called the world's most unstable macroeconomic bloc. From 2008 to 2017, the Eurozone's average annual economic growth was just 0.6%. From 2018 through 2021, the growth rate was even worse, just 0.5%, putting the Eurozone on track for a second consecutive lost decade. Despite the clear failure of austerity policies in producing growth, President Emmanuel Macron will continue with far-right economics in his second term. His finance minister boasted of plans to cut much-needed public spending to a 20-year low, citing a desire to submit to Brussels' entirely arbitrary 3% rule on public deficits.
We're talking about a systemic crisis in Europe, and one which existed before the crisis caused by the pandemic, as well as the crisis caused by the need to find alternative energy sources other than Russia. What it all adds up to is that a state of crisis continuing still.
This week, the new and deeply fractured National Assembly passed the Emergency Purchasing Power Bill, aimed at countering still rising once-in-a-generation inflation. At just 20 billion